Hello, I'm Damika Aline. This is number 0704, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0704. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Philip Fracassi, who is the author of the horror novel entitled Gothic. Even though the thriller deals with a horror novelist who has a bout of writer's block, similarities don't exist between Philip and his main character.
There are definitely a lot of writer psychology dumped into Tyson, and while it's not autobiographical or in any sense, some of the stuff that writers go through is, you know, with publishers or psychologically, emotionally, a lot of that's in the book and in Tyson's character. Part of the reason I think writers suffer from imposter syndrome, why writers are somewhat insecure, I think that writing is something that comes from a source that we can't define. You know, a lot of times you'll see writers talk about, you know, someone will read back a passage from one of their books and they'll be like, I have no recollection of writing that passage, but it sure sounds nice. I think writers get insecure because it's hard for us to explain to people how we do what we do.
Lawyer J.D. Mortmain looks at the lighter side of the law with his book, The Fuzzy Pink Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. He discovered the humor in courtrooms almost from the beginning.
I started off as a JAG officer, Judge Advocate General for the Army, and one of my first cases was so phenomenal that I had to write it down and share it with other people. So almost immediately did I discover there are a lot of good stories out there.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hear ye, hear ye. This is Stuart Nullman, your town crier, to announce that this edition of Book Banter will take a look at the eye-opening memoir of Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex. The royal family is not amused, but you will be later on the Stuff File program. Hear ye, hear ye.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0704, was Damika Aline, who is my niece. She is also a university student studying languages, and she works as an assistant manager at Mastermind Toys. Thank you, Damika, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Love you. A show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Momo, the lar gibbon who lives at a zoo in Nagasaki, Japan, delivered a baby in February of 2021, which surprised zookeepers since Momo lived in her own enclosure with no males around. She was very protective of the offspring, so it wasn't until 2 years later that handlers were able to collect DNA from the youngster to determine who the father was. As it turned out, a 34-year-old agile gibbon named Itu was the baby daddy.
You are the father!
Zookeepers found that a partition between Momo's exhibit and Itu's off-display area had a perforated board with holes about 9 millimeters in diameter, and they believe the two were able to mate through one of those holes. Wow, I believe there's a name for such a hole. Anyway, the perforated board was replaced with a steel plate, but Momo and Itu will be introduced properly to each other so they can live, perhaps, as a family. Well, at this point, is an introduction really necessary? Yeah. A 37-year-old Robert Powers managed to terrorize multiple citizens in Altoona, Pennsylvania on February the 6th. He allegedly broke into 4 different homes, telling one woman, as he covered her mouth,
"I'm Batman."
At the next home, he choked a man, went through his pockets, and held him hostage with a pocket knife. Next, he turned the man's gas stove on and forced him to his truck, heading across town at speeds of more than 100 miles per hour before crashing into a Jeep. Powers then kicked open a door of a nearby home and repeatedly asked, "Why you do this, Mom?" as he walked through the residence. Finally, at the last crime scene, police were able to subdue Powers, who admitted he may have ingested meth or bath salts. Yeah. You know, telling a woman that
I'm Batman
isn't going to endear you to the cops. Most of them don't like the Caped Crusader anyway. Now, if you've been pulled over by the police, chances are that you're in trouble for some reason or another. Let's see if we can add up the plethora of infractions that befell a BC man from Saanich. Number one, you're driving while impaired. That's not a good start. Number two, you're impersonating a peace officer driving around a car equipped with flashing lights similar to those of a police vehicle. Not looking good, huh? Number three, you have possession of drugs for the purpose of trafficking in your counterfeit cop car. Number four, because you've had past scrapes with the law, you're prohibited from having a firearm and there's a BB gun in your car. Number five, there is a young child in the back seat. The early 1990s Chrysler Dynasty with flashing blue and white lights was driving erratically at high speeds on the Trans-Canada Highway. Police caught up to the vehicle when it got off the highway and pulled into a gas station. In addition to the police lights, the vehicle also had a CB radio with a coiled boom microphone inside and a large fixed antenna on the outside, similar to those seen on cop cars. Officers arrested the driver for impaired driving. The child was turned over to a family member. Wow. Driving while impaired, in a fake cop car, trying to traffic drugs with a BB gun and a child in the car. In one fell swoop, that is a five-time loser. 21-year-old Trevin Wayne Hill, oh, there's that middle name Wayne again, of Las Vegas let it all hang out on January 28th when he approached another guest in the stairwell of the Des Moines, Iowa downtown Marriott. Court documents said Hill was naked and brandishing a toilet plunger when he yelled, "I'm going to bleeping get you," while chasing the other person. Hill cruised around the hotel in his birthday suit, destroying a sprinkler system and pulling several fire alarms before finally being subdued by firefighters. Hill pleaded not guilty to assault, first-degree criminal mischief, and disorderly conduct. You know, to me, this story isn't complete because what I really want to know is just how was he planning on using that toilet plunger? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Oh, the bells signify that it's time once again for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
On January 16th, Brazilian attorney Leandro Mateus de Nueves delivered his mother to the Laboratório Cura in Sao Paulo, where she was scheduled for an MRI. Before they both entered the MRI room, they were asked to remove any metal objects from their persons and signed a form detailing the protocols. But Leandro opted to not remove or disclose his concealed weapon. When the MRI's magnetic field yanked the pistol from his waistband, it fired and struck him in the stomach. He was hospitalized for 3 weeks after the incident, but died on February the 6th. This is what happens when you don't pay attention to the rules, and speaking of rules, this is also why the Tree of Life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
And let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Critically acclaimed horror writer Philip Fracassi is the author of his latest novel that is simply called Gothic. Philip joins us via Zoom from California. Hi, Philip.
Hey, Peter, thank you for allowing me to be on your show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, in looking over the synopsis of this book, and I'll read it directly from the press release. It says, on his birthday, Tyson Parks, a famous but struggling horror writer, receives an antique desk from his partner, Sarah, in the hopes it will rekindle his creative juices. Now, before we get into what happens in the story, I gotta know, have you ever had writer's block to the point where a desk would be helpful?
You know, no. But you know what is helpful is presence to oneself. is a nice morale boost. And I think that was kind of where the idea sort of stemmed from, was the idea that she just felt he needed something to cheer him up and kind of shake things up a bit. And that was the impetus for the desk being first gifted to Tyson.
Okay, so as I said, it's a horror story, so it's a little more complicated than simply someone getting a desk. Tell us what the story is about.
Yeah, so basically the desk has a very long history that goes back to the Middle Ages, and some of that is discussed in the book, in kind of like there are chapters throughout the book that kind of get into the history of the desk and what exactly it is. You know, the fact that you do find out that it's not actually a desk, it just happens to be an object that kind of morphs as it goes through time and finds different owners. And so when it gets to Tyson, who is a horror writer who is trying to get back into the swing of things after having some huge hits in the, you know, 80s and 90s, and kind of struggling with, you know, is under a lot of pressure to come up with another big hit. And the desk sort of opens a portal between him and another world, and bad things come through and whisper things to him. And he has kind of a, you know, Faustian choice of whether to choose success or to choose, you know, basically sanity and his family. And so that's kind of the moral dilemma that plays on throughout the book.
Okay, so we've already established the fact that it's not autobiographical.
Right.
But having said that, as a writer, as a successful writer, in the back of your mind, does what Tyson go through, you ever worry about, what if my last hit was my last hit? What if I can't do this anymore?
Yeah, yes. There are definitely a lot of writer psychology dumped into Tyson. And while it's not autobiographical in any sense, there's definitely some shared concern. You know, some of the stuff that writers go through is, you know, with publishers or psychologically, emotionally, a lot of that's in the book and in Tyson's character. And one of the things I wanted to mention was, like, you know, the thing about the muse, which is such an interesting subject, is because for writers, and part of the reason I think writers suffer from imposter syndrome, why writers are somewhat insecure, is because I think, unlike a lot of honed talents like sculptor or, you know, or a musician, I think writing is something that is comes from a source that we can't really define. It's, you know, a lot of times you'll see writers talk about, you know, someone will read back a passage from one of their books and they'll be like, I have no recollection of writing that passage, but it sure sounds nice. And I think writers get insecure because it's hard for us to explain to people how we do what we do. We just, you know, a doorway opens in our brains when we sit down and stuff pours through. And you never know if that door is going to open or not. And so it's kind of terrifying to be a writer in that sense. And I think with Tyson is that door is open in his mind, a new door is opened in his mind, a new muse comes through, but it ends up being a very dangerous one. So that's kind of the basis for his psychology going through, you know, why it's hard for him to let go of this desk once things get dangerous for him, because, you know, he doesn't want that door to close.
Well, speaking of terrifying being a writer, as someone who writes horror stories and gothic novels, or your latest novel is called Gothic.
Yeah.
Do you ever scare yourself while you're writing?
I'm scared all the time, man. I'm like the biggest scaredy cat in the world. I'm convinced there's a ghost, an evil entity that lives in our bathroom, and I won't sleep at night if the bathroom door is not closed firmly. I am constantly thinking there are things like crawling up my bedspread at night. I don't like holes in the ground. I have all these weird paranoia. So I'm scared all the time. I scare very easily. I think what happens when you're a horror writer is you have an overactive imagination, and you lean toward things being bad versus good. I don't look at an empty doorway and see like, oh, I wonder if that goes through to the some Narnia-esque fantasy land, I think, oh, that's a portal to hell. And so I scare pretty easily, but it is something I try and at least work into my own stories if I can.
Now, you've also written screenplays, and I'm just curious to know from your perspective, is writing a screenplay using a different mental muscle than writing a novel? Does the process change because of the two genres of writing that you do?
Yeah, I mean, you approach it very, very differently. I mean, a screenplay is very technical, first of all. You can't really be artistically crazy. You have to kind of follow structure because you have a lot of people who are going to be involved in making what you're putting and creating what you're putting down on paper. So a screenplay is really a foundation for which others to build upon. So you have to deal with costumes, you have to deal with locations, you have to deal with actors, you have to deal with the director, obviously. So it's very much you're very much a tool in what is ultimately a team effort. Whereas when you're writing fiction, it's, you know, I'm the writer, director, producer, costumer, you know, and everything. So it's very much about my art, very much. It's very personal. It's very much something I'm much more protective of. And so it's two complete and even just technically it's very different approach. You know, I do tend to carry over some of my screenwriting tools into my fiction. I'm very, you know, one of my, you know, more developed skills is story structure. And I'm a big outliner when it comes to writing a novel, which a lot of writers tend to just kind of write off the cuff when they have a general idea. I like to outline the entire thing, you know, extensively. And that comes from sort of my screenwriing side of things. But yeah, it's two totally different approaches, and it's two kind of totally different things once they're even created. One is very much part of a team effort, like I said, and one's very much just about me and what I want to be on that page.
Well, let's talk about the nuts and bolts of putting together a book like Gothic, where your work has been described as adrenaline-pumping horror. And the reason why I bring that up is because I'm just wondering, do you have a formula or an idea of, for lack of a better term, how many scares per page or how many scares per chapter? Or do you just let the story flow and it's scary enough as it is?
Yeah, no, that's very much a screenwriting thing, though, where they'll say, like, look, we need a scare every 10 pages, you know, or whatever, to keep the audience engaged. But with fiction, not so much. Although I do tend... It's more of an instinctual thing versus a technical thing. If I feel the story's moving along, but maybe I'm in a 50 page section of the story where, you know, I'm more about character development, or I'm kind of building world building, or I'm setting up, you know, what's going to end up being like the third act. Sometimes I'll throw like a little something in there, you know, to kind of, you know, tweak the reader a little bit to give them a little, you know, don't let me lose you, you know, here kind of thing. So that, but it's more instinctual as I go through a novel, because a novel is such a massive project. And I mean, any novel could be, you know, a 2-3 season TV show. I mean, there's a lot going on in most novels, a lot of characters, a lot of development. But every now and then, though, I'll keep an eye on that. And if I feel like maybe the reader needs a little jolt, I might throw something in there just to kind of give them a little scare, but with fiction, you really kind of, you're almost creating a sense of dread. You're creating a sense of, you know, you're immersing the reader into this sort of like world that you hope makes them uneasy and hope create, you know, ratchets up the tension so they keep flipping the pages. But it's not necessarily about like in a films or a horror movie where there's jump scares or things like that. So it's more of an instinctual thing. It tends to be more about the overall feel of what you're writing versus like individual moments.
Well, since you are a screenwriter, would you like to see Gothic turn into a film, either for the small or big screen?
Man, I would love Gothic to be turned into a film. I have actually written a screenplay for the novel, and I've written a screenplay for a couple of my novels, and kind of like just in case. And I've optioned a few short stories to producers and a couple studios. So I would love to see Gothic get turned in. I'm hoping Sam Raimi reads it and makes it with his because he's my one of my heroes in the filmmaking world. So, but anyone who would be interested in making it, I think it'd be a really fun movie, kind of a wild ride sort of film. So hopefully Hollywood calls on that one.
Well, the book is called Gothic. And Philip, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Of course, Peter. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Philip Fracassi, author of the horror novel Gothic. You can go to my website at thestuffwild.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0704, and you'll find links to Philip's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Available on Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and just about every other way you stream audio. This is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's everywhere you want to be. In some places you don't.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Fuzzy Pink Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. Plus, Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way, and lots of Stuff File news, including right here, right now. Jose Ruben Nava, former director of a zoo in Mexico, is under fire after officials learned that he slaughtered 4 pygmy goats to serve at the zoo's year-end dinner. Fernando Ruiz Gutierrez, director of wildlife for the state's Environment Department, said serving the goat meat put the health of the people who ate them at risk because these animals were not fit for human consumption. The state Environment Department said a zebra was traded for tools and deer and Watusi cattle were traded off to private individuals without proper accounting. As for the zoo zebra, that trade was for some tools needed to fix things around the zoo, but an inspection did not locate any such tools at the facility. Nava was let go from his position in January after the death of a deer at the zoo. Well, you know, since pygmy goats aren't fit for human consumption, where exactly do you find a recipe for it? And is anybody the least bit curious about what else they're serving at the zoo's year-end dinner? Meanwhile, this next story is a counterpunch to the last one. A 61-year-old butcher working at a slaughterhouse in Hong Kong died at the hands, or should I say, hooves, of a pig he was trying to slaughter on January 20th. The unnamed man was knocked to the ground by the struggling pig, which had revived after a shot from a stun gun, and suffered a wound from a meat cleaver. Strangely, police said the man's wounds were to his hand and foot. A cause of death has not been released. The Labor Department extended its deepest sympathy to his family. What? Did they send them a sympathy ham? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the state of Oregon discovered that among its 19 volumes of laws, there isn't any prohibition of unlawful kangaroo exchange. The state's Senate Judiciary Committee is considering Senate Bill 764, which would make it illegal to sell any part of a dead kangaroo or any product containing a part of a dead kangaroo. The bill is apparently in response to Nike, which is headquartered in the state. It sells shoes with cleats made from kangaroo leather. Making leather from ruse is not only legal in Australia, it's encouraged by its government. Still, violators in Oregon would be subject to a year in jail and/or $6,250 in fines. Wow. I'm guessing to enforce this law, Oregon would have to set up a kangaroo court. Anyway, speaking of law, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Movies and television portray the courtroom as a dramatic place full of nail-biting tension, but in real life, that's not always the case. In fact, there's often more humor than horror happening behind closed doors. J.D. Mortmain is the author of The Fuzzy Pink Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. He joins us via Zoom from West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, J.D.
How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So you've been in the legal profession for a very long time. How early in your tenure as a lawyer did you realize that there's a little more fun and a little more levity in the judicial system in the courtroom than you were led to believe?
Well, I started off as a JAG officer, Judge Advocate General for the Army. And one of my first cases was so phenomenal that I had to write it down and share it with other people. So almost immediately did I discover there are a lot of good stories out there.
Well, what was that first one that you felt you had to write down?
Well, this was about Private Hicks. Now, Private Hicks was a wire layer in Korea. And after 5 years, he was he suffered a traumatic amputation or partial traumatic amputation of the brain. So the question was whether he was competent or incompetent. If he was competent, he'd get no benefits. He was incompetent, he'd get a military disability pension for the rest of his life. So I was appointed to help him through the hearing of whether he was competent or incompetent. I met with him ahead of time and I asked him what he did. He said, I lived in Maine, Northeast Harbor, and he said that there were two movie theaters. And I said, I'm thinking to myself, this guy's crazy. Why is he talking about two movie theaters? And he said, well, and I have two girlfriends, neither of whom know about the other one. One comes in every Wednesday, cleans my apartment, cooks me a meal, does my wash. I take her to one movie. The other one comes in on Sunday, the same thing. So I'm thinking, if this is insanity, count me in. When he appeared, by the way, he had his uniform on. I looked at his shoes. They're spit shined. His trousers were creased, but his fly was open. And then I went up further and he hadn't shaven. And I'm thinking to myself, he's a Skid Row bum. But he says, geez, he said, I lost my shaving gear in Bangor when I changed buses and my zipper broke. I have to have that fixed. So then we got to talking about his life up in Maine. And he says he likes to read. He has the biggest library in town, bigger than the town library. He likes to play chess, but there's only one fellow that makes it interesting for him. And that was it. He said, there's nothing wrong with me. I want you to fight to get me so that I can reenlist. And I'm thinking to myself, that's unrealistic. He's got a metal plate in his head. They're not going to take him. They say that he's an alcoholic, which he denies. Even if I convince the court there's nothing wrong with him, will he be able to get back into the service? So anyway, we get into the hearing, and there's five-member board of officers, and the person chairing it, a Colonel White, is interrupted by Major Mike, the Army psychiatrist. And Major Mike says, Colonel, I can very quickly determine whether this person is competent just by asking him a few proverbs. Carry on, Major. So the Major says with a tone of derision, he says, Private, what does this mean? A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And Hicks, without thinking, says, don't count your chickens before they hatch. And I'm thinking, this guy's brilliant. I've never connected those two sayings. There's an embarrassing silence because the Major doesn't understand the answer. He says, let me ask you another one. A stitch in time saves nine. And Hicks says, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So I'm thinking, this is brilliant. And then there's an embarrassing silence. The Major doesn't understand the answer. So Hicks volunteers, for want of a nail, the horse was lost. And I'm thinking to myself, that is brilliant. He says, well, let me ask you another. Mighty oaks from small acorns grow. And Hicks says, mighty rivers from small streams flow. And I'm thinking, I've never heard that one before, but that's really good. So then the major says, don't judge a book by its cover. And Hicks says, all that glitters is not gold. And again, I'm really astounded by the quickness of this Private Hicks. So anyway, he's finally asked, don't cry over spilt milk. And Hicks can't think of an answer in a proverb like that. So he tells the story, where it was published, name of the daughter, the farmer, the cow, the cat, and we're excused. We get to the door of the courtroom, and he turns to me, and Hicks says, well, that's water over the dam. So I thought that was just absolutely brilliant. They found that he was disabled, by the way.
Really?
Yes.
Hmm.
Well, you know, I figured that if the major doesn't understand the answers, he's not going to be able to pass the test.
Now, the book is entitled The Fuzzy Pink Bathroom or Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. So yes. Tell us about the fuzzy pink bathrobe.
Well, that involved a case in which my client came to me, and she said that she was divorced, but she never got notice of it. And I asked her, was she served? She said she wasn't. Did she sign a separation agreement? No, she did not. Was she represented by an attorney? No, she was not. And then I looked at the file, and it turned out that the sheriff said that he had served her. She had hired an attorney, a very prominent political-type attorney, and she had written a separation agreement. She signed it, and it gave everything to the husband except for $10,000 to the wife. But she swore up and down that she hadn't known about it. So we got into investigating it, and it turned out that he had hired an imposter to be at her house to say that she was the wife and to accept the service of process from the sheriff. And then the imposter went to an attorney, hired an attorney, and the attorney represented her, being the imposter, and they worked out a deal, and the husband got the kids and the house and everything else, and it just didn't make sense. Well, the fuzzy pink bathrobe is what the imposter was wearing when the sheriff served her. She had rubber gloves on, so she would not leave any fingerprints on the documents. And the sheriff, when it got to trial, had to identify her, the real wife, as the person she had served. We had put a fuzzy pink bathrobe on the table because I figured that the sheriff would recognize the bathrobe, even though did not recognize the woman. And sure enough, he claimed that that woman was the person she had served. The attorney claimed that that woman was the person who he had represented. And then it turned out that the woman that was on the stand was an actress who had been in England for 6 months during this whole episode. So needless to say, the judge decided that he was going to vacate the judgment and get a new trial.
Hmm. Is it often a situation, or is it rare a situation where you have unbelievable situations that take place within a courtroom that you are, shall I say, unprepared for?
Occasionally, these things happen. There's a case in which I was representing the husband, in a custody case. The psychiatrist testified that he had poor impulse control, whereupon he jumped up and said, "That's a lie." And that was that proved that he had poor impulse control. So that took me by surprise.
Sometimes you're at the mercy of what your client is or isn't, I would assume.
Yes. And although there is supposed to be a cardinal rule that never lie to your lawyer, the fact is very often clients lie to their lawyers, thinking that if a lawyer believes them, he'll be able to do miracles.
Well, luckily, you share the truth. the whole truth and nothing but the truth in your book, The Fuzzy Pink Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. J.D., I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. Nice being with you.
J.D. Mortmain, author of The Fuzzy Pink Bathrobe and Other Tales of the Law. You can go to my website at thestuffwild.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0704, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Hey, how would you like to become a patron of the Stuff File program? It's easy to do. By going to patreon.com and becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. If you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. Join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And when it comes to book royalty, there is no other person besides Stuart Nolman. Hello, Stu.
Thanks, Peter. This crown is a little bit heavy on my head. Give me a second to take it off.
Ugh. Well, yeah. Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Yes, because that's made by reading a lot of books, Peter. Because on this edition of Book Banter, if I had to theme to the series The Crown, I'd play it right now as background music, but I don't. But we're going to look at the first ever memoir by an actual member of the British royal family. Critics may call Prince Harry whiny or crybaby, but Harry gives an inside look at life being a royal that no former assistant, valet, or bodyguard could offer. And what he has to say is not pretty. In fact, it's quite eye-opening and infuriating at the same time. Now, being a spare, which is the title of the book, in this family, in the shadow of his brother and the heir of the royal crown, Prince William, is almost like being a middle child, only more painful and under more intense scrutiny.
In your family dynamic, where are you exactly?
Middle.
Okay. I just rest my case. Go on.
You're just asking. That's great. But the book itself focuses on five aspects of Harry's life. The death of Diana and how it affected him. The battle with the British tabloid press. His relationship and marriage to Meghan Markle. His service in the army. And the difficulties with the family after Diana's death. Now, the text is peppered with many examples of stream of conscience. And, basically get an idea of what's going on in Harry's mind when he is confronted with a situation, whether it be joyous, self-affirming, or adverse. But you may think it's the foundation for a pity party or a kumbaya moment. But what it boils down to is someone who carried a whole lot of hurt and pain and is now basically airing it out as honestly as possible. And there's lots of regrets and pride to exhibit. For example, he saves his pride and joy when discussing his relationship and, with Meghan and, the ups and downs that go with it. But he saves his venom for the British tabloid press, especially two members who he titled Tweedledum and Tweedledumber. and all the leaks that, you know, went along with it. It was like, you know, Meghan or Harry couldn't even, they sneezed in the wrong direction to make the front page of the tabloids the following day. But, you know what? Let me tell you something. When you read the book and you get this feeling that he's been abandoned, you know, he also exhibits this feeling of abandonment by Charles and William and members of the firm. That's what the nickname for the royal family is. And especially their cold-hearted assistants, who Harry dubs as the bee, the fly, and the wasp.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, as I've mentioned on more than one occasion, I'm a monarchist. I don't apologize for that. But I do have my issues, not with the royal family, but with the firm. And there are a lot of, shall we say, in the old silent reel type of movies, there are some real mustache twirlers amongst that group.
Oh, yes. ready to tie up someone to the railroad track.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I can see the issues from both sides, and by that I mean both sides of the argument here as to what maybe some of the royals are saying and what Prince Harry is saying. I can literally see both sides, but I think they do have a common enemy.
Yeah. There is that common denominator. But you know what? In conclusion, say what you will. I thought this book was a courageous, audacious, and very gutsy way to explain that life in the shadow of something bigger than himself was tough, but he's basically fought, and he's still fighting to find the light beyond the shadow.
Yeah. I've said ever since it came out, I know why he had to write it. I'm sorry that he had to write it. That's the way I feel about that whole thing. You know, it's like, yeah. point to the very tabloid writers that he's talking about, and to a certain degree, when it comes to promotion of a book, sometimes mm-hmm. the promotion machine gets ahead of its skis. You know, if you hear long interviews where Harry talks about some of the issues within the book, mm-hmm. you get the full gist of what he's saying, as opposed to the snippets that are coming out to promote the book, which the tabloid press, who already hates him, are going to run with.
Yeah, it's like more cannon fodder to feed them.
Exactly.
You know, and gives more chance for the tabloid people, especially who Harry calls the paps, the paparazzi, more ammunition.
Yeah. And I also think we're all glad to know that his penis is finally thawed.
Oh, yeah. I was worried you were going to, you know, bring that issue to the forefront.
Yeah.
But, to me, that part of the book, if I may compare it to Alfred Hitchcock's concept of the red herring, which he called the MacGuffin.
Yes. Well,
enough said.
It's bringing new meaning to a royal member.
Yeah. No, we could go on with this little issue, but it just like I said, just it's there, but it, you know, doesn't contribute greatly to the development of the narrative.
Yeah,
it's just there.
He's still doing. He's a ginger who's still doing better than the ginger from Gilligan's Island. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
and by that I mean, if anybody ever reads any of the books that anybody's ever written about that show, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yes. I mean, and no matter who wrote the books.
No matter who wrote the book, exactly. Anyway, the book is this week's book is
called Spare by Prince Harry, and it's published by Random House Canada, and it's $47.
And what other tomes of this nature do you recommend?
Well, the tomes that I do recommend, first of all, if you are a fan of The Crown or you're about to watch The Crown, which is an excellent series, Robert Lacey, who's a well-known authority and author, best-selling author about the British royal family and other dynasties too, wrote two viewer's guides about The Crown, covering the period between 1947 and 1977, which gives the person, the devoted viewer or future viewer, the historical context of the series, but not just like chronological, but each chapter deals with an episode of that of the series. So I thought it was a great approach, if you ask me. So Robert Lacey really did a really great job, and it's lavishly illustrated too. But it just puts the first two or three seasons of The Crown into historical context.
And I know it's not a book, but if you're talking about The Crown, I really have to stress once again, and I'm a big fan of that show, surprise, surprise, that if you watch The Crown, you must listen to the official Crown podcast. Watch it, listen to it rather, episode by episode, after you watch episode by episode. The two are companions that must stay together. It'll give you the width and breadth of history, both in the historical significance of what is happening in an episode and what it took to shoot said episode. So it's a fantastic podcast to go along
with. I agree
with
you. I started listening to it. Great recommendation.
Yeah, it's great, great show. Anyway, this week's book again is?
It's called Spare by Prince Harry. It's published by Random House Canada, and it's $47.
Thank you very much. How can we find you, sir? I'm assuming it's not on the throne.
No, not the actual throne or my own throne or in the halls of Buckingham Palace, but on the pages of the Montreal Times, not the not those tabloids there. Go to www.mtltimes.ca, and there you'll find me. I am not a pap or a Tweedledummer.
Excellent. You are royalty. You are literary royalty. Thank you very much, Stuart, once again for being on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and a few more Stuff File stories right here, right now. A pest control technician investigating an insect problem at a California home made a startling discovery. About 700 pounds of acorns had been stashed inside the house's wall by woodpeckers. Nick Castro of Nick's Extreme Pest Control said he expected to find a dead animal inside the wall of the home where residents reported seeing maggots and mealworms emerging from a wall. Castro cut a small hole in the wall of the second floor bedroom and was shocked to see acorns starting to pour out from the opening. Castro and his colleagues discovered the acorns were piled about 20 feet high inside the wall. He estimated about 700 pounds of acorns were removed. The technician said he investigated outside the home and discovered woodpeckers had been poking holes in the chimney stack and had been stashing acorns in the openings for the past 2 to 5 years. The acorns eventually fell through into the wall cavity. It took about 8 hours to remove the acorns. Castro repaired the damage to the home's exterior and added screens to protect the wood from the birds. Wow, 700 pounds of acorns. Somewhere out there is an extremely jealous squirrel. Detectives from the Broward County, Florida Sheriff's Office investigated a string of burglaries of rental car agencies at the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport. The only thing taken each time, the car's key fobs. After careful investigation, authorities announced that they had their man. 31-year-old Armando Martinez was arrested on 143 counts of burglary of a conveyance, and he allegedly confessed. They put the estimated total loss of the key fobs at more than $77,000. So, basically, the real crime here is not just the fact that Martinez stole 143 key fobs. It's the fact that the key fobs supposedly cost more than $538 each. That's why, even without COVID, when you go into a car dealership, they should be wearing masks. A rural road outside Tracy, California was washed out in the mid-January storms, and a multi-foot gap spanning edge to edge was created. Now, the California Highway Patrol put up concrete barriers and conspicuous road close signs with flashing lights. It was clear that the road couldn't be fixed for weeks, but sure enough, a car went around the barrier and fell in. A few days later, a silver car did the same thing. "We are at a loss for words," the CHP posted with a photo. "If only there were signs and or barriers that could have prevented this." Days later, a silver pickup truck did the same thing. "This can't be real," the CHP posted in all caps with another photo. The CHP noted that each driver was given a citation. Now, I have posted the CHP pics of these morons' vehicles that are now giant paperweights on our Stuff File Program Facebook fan page and also on Twitter. These self-righteous people who can blatantly ignore such road-closed signs shouldn't even be allowed to drive pedal cars. And Ossine Moyne was to direct Waiting for Godot at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, but the absurdist play was canceled. All the characters are male. "No," said an official with the Student Culture Center, "that wasn't the problem. The problem was that the auditions had only been open to men." Go figure. Yeah. Anyway, said a university spokesperson, "The idea that only men are suitable for this role, part of playwright Samuel Beckett's version of Godot, and thus a contract requirement to perform it, is outdated and even discriminatory." Interesting. Little known fact, the copyright for a play runs out 70 years after the playwright's death, meaning women and non-binary performers legally have to wait until the end of 2059 to be able to play Vladimir and Estragon. In the meantime, I'm looking forward to the university mounting a very unconventional version of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. And 54-year-old Nako Ray Brown has pleaded guilty to robbing a bank in Belle Isle, Florida, but he had a good reason. He told investigators he's a movie producer and robbed the bank to fund a movie he wanted to make. Brown was on probation after serving 19 years of a 25-year prison sentence for three previous bank robberies in Maryland. His sentencing date had not yet been set, but he faces up to 20 years in prison again, plus 3 years for violating his probation. How was he caught? A witness saw him run from the bank to a gas station where he changed his clothes and then sauntered off. The witness told police where he had gone, and they found the demand note and stolen cash. His disguise was found in the gas station's restroom. Oh, there's probably going to be a movie, all right, but not made by him. And boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A Michigan teacher is facing charges after allegedly planting a bomb threat note in his classroom to get a day off. The note was found on February 2nd in the Hazel Park Junior High School classroom of 40-year-old Paul Jacobs of Livonia. It said the school would be blown up the next day. Police initially thought Jacobs saw the note but failed to report it. The building was searched by officers and canine units, and no explosives were discovered. Now they believe Jacobs planted the note himself with the intention of classes being canceled. Jacobs is charged with making an intentional threat of an act of violence against a school, employees, or students, which is a 1-year misdemeanor. Now, why? Oh, why? If you just needed a day off and a long weekend, couldn't you call in sick instead of planting a bomb threat, thus acting more like an ultra-juvenile student than a teacher and molder of young minds? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0704. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0704. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, KZZHLPFM in Eureka, California, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your humble announcer, Ben Patrick Johnson. Don't let Peter fool you. This program would be nothing without me. What you hear in the rest of the show isn't even Peter's real voice. It's all special effects. His actual voice has officially been deemed as torture by the Geneva Convention.